76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and NORML staff and NORML's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to NORML's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it is Tuesday, October 2nd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment right now to join us at NORML to help end marijuana prohibition in America. It's as easy as visiting norml.org to make your donation or join NORML today. Folks, there are still a limited number of tickets available for the NORML Annual Conference in Los Angeles starting next Friday on October 12th. You can register for the conference online at normal.org. We also have links at normalaudiostash.com. This year's conference is certainly going to be one to remember. Tommy Chong will be there. Rick Steves will be there. David Knott from the Reason Foundation will be there. Allison Holcomb from the ACLU. Paul Armentano, NORML's Senior Policy Analyst. Keith Strupp, NORML's Founder. Alan St. Pierre, NORML's Executive Director, along with dozens of other speakers. More information about the conference is available online at normal.org, and you can listen to presentations from last year's, the 2006 NORML Conference, on the NORML Events podcast. That's at normal.org/podcast. We're going to dive into the archive of past NORML conference audio throughout the week this week. On Friday, we'll hear Bill Maher's 2005 NORML conference keynote speech. Bill is on the NORML advisory board and frequently discusses marijuana legalization and reform on his television programs and live shows. So Bill Maher's 2005 conference address coming up this Friday here on the Audio Stash. Today here on the program, we'll get the chance to speak with Gary Stork of Wisconsin NORML during our Government at Work segment. There are two important pieces of legislation going before the Wisconsin legislature this fall. One deals with medical marijuana, the other with industrial hemp farming. We'll speak with Gary about those bills today. Also, we'll discuss the upcoming Harvest Festival taking place Saturday and Sunday. We'll have music from the Harvest Festival throughout the week here on the Audio Stash as well. We've got links to Wisconsin NORML and the Harvest Festival right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Also in the program today, we'll speak with Ryan King from the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. He's co-author of a new paper, The 25-Year Quagmire, The War on Drugs and Its Impact on Society, really highlighting the half-million American prisoners behind bars for a prohibition-related violation. So Ryan King, later on the program today, we have links to that paper right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Tomorrow on the program, our cannabis science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, we'll look at how teenagers are making the decision to use marijuana and other illicit substances. Turns out the DARE programs and other so-called drug education programs aren't having much of an impact on how people make that decision. That's tomorrow in our cannabis science segment. Let's open up the stash today with our Government at Work weekly segment. On Government at Work, we'll speak with Gary Stork, the director of Madison, Wisconsin's Normal Chapter. There's a lot of legislative activity taking place in Wisconsin this year. If you're a Wisconsin resident, make sure to take action in the Normal Take Action Center. Write your state elected officials to urge them to support these bills. We'll have links to Wisconsin Normal on our website today as well. Gary, welcome here to the Audio Stash.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Great to speak with you today, Gary. There are a couple of important pieces of legislation gaining steam there in Wisconsin and a big festival happening this weekend. Let's begin with the medical marijuana legislation. The bill is named after a longtime medical cannabis activist, Jackie Rickert. Gary, tell us about how this bill has started out.
Quite the important act. I think I'm really pleased that it's being named after Jackie Rickert because she's been a symbol for medical marijuana so long in Wisconsin. And we're getting good press, although the usual opponents are beginning to surface. There was an article today in the Eau Claire Leader Telegram where Representative Scott Souter reared his ugly head again. But I think the visibility of the issue is growing, and I'm more confident, if not this session, the next session.
And how do Wisconsin residents feel about medical marijuana? What are the general attitudes about medical use?
Well, it's pretty much like everywhere else. Is my medicine legal yet? Did a poll back in 2002, and we found upwards of 80% support statewide and higher in some areas, particularly Dane County, where Madison is. But it was pretty much even around the state, and the support was also pretty consistent whether voters or respondents identified themselves as Democrats, Republicans, or Independents.
And should the bill become law, how would medical marijuana be implemented in the state?
It would be, the bill as written is similar to the model in Oregon and states like that, where patients or designated caregivers are allowed to cultivate and possess a certain amount of cannabis. In this case, the bill says 10 plants and 85 grams of usable material. So they would be exempted from prosecution with a doctor's note, and they would have to register with the state.
I have to ask, have you heard from individuals who are already using medical cannabis that they're sometimes harassed?
Yeah, it happens. It depends what part of the state you live in. Some parts of Wisconsin can be pretty draconian for any kind of cannabis use, but I think slowly and surely, consciousness is arising that people using cannabis for medicine really aren't the enemy. And I have heard some amazing episodes of leniency on the part of officials from around the state.
Now, the city of Madison has a long-standing marijuana decriminalization ordinance. Is that attitude towards marijuana unique to the Madison area, or do you think it's shared around the state?
Well, Madison kind of transcends not only the state of Wisconsin, but the Midwest. I don't think you'll find a more cannabis-friendly climate, perhaps, without going out to the coast here. We not only have a 30-year-old local decrim ordinance, which also legalizes personal possession in your home and medical use, but there's also a county ordinance and earlier this year, the district attorney announced that he would no longer prosecute any cases involving 25 grams or less as anything other than a ticket, and paraphernalia cases would be the same. So, it was pretty much decriminalized before. This is the first time where they've actually stated a policy, so hopefully there won't be any outliers where somebody with 7 grams all of a sudden is facing criminal charges and somebody with 25 isn't. You know, hopefully there's going to be at least a blanket decrim for under 25 grams at this point.
Righto, Gary. Well, we'll check in with you on that as the bill moves forward here this fall. There's another very interesting piece of legislation I'd like to discuss today as well. We've seen the issue of hemp farming really pick up steam around the country this year. There's the Federal Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007 before the U.S. Congress, and the California legislature just passed a hemp farming bill that would start a pilot program in four counties. That's awaiting the signature of Governor Schwarzenegger there. And now Wisconsin is considering hemp farming as well. So tell us a bit about this hemp bill, Gary.
Yeah, I happened to be at the hearing for that bill back on April 18th up at the Capitol, and although it's already legal in Wisconsin to grow hemp, what's unique about this bill, which basically creates a panel to study it, is that it was proposed by Republicans, and at least half of the co-sponsors, if not more, are Republicans, and there's also some people on the bill, Republicans, who have been very hostile to medical cannabis. So it's good to see at least they're getting some idea that cannabis is useful when it helps, when it can help out the agriculture and industrial sections of the state economy.
And is there interest in hemp farming and in this bill from the mainstream agricultural community there?
Yeah, very much so. It was very exciting at the hearing to see a father and son older farmer and his son in his 40s, and they're on their family farm. They've been growing hemp. They grew hemp back during World War II for the federal government, and they brought along their hemp stamp from 1944 and Marijuana Tax Act stamp, and it was beautiful to gaze upon it, and they were very extremely eloquent about not only growing it but also very accurate on how much fertilizer it needed and that kind of thing, and they really helped win over the committee.
And how have the state legislators responded to this bill so far?
It's been extremely pleasant to see legislators from both sides of the aisle and the middle getting on this bill. It's got basically a cross-section of the political spectrum in Wisconsin are co-sponsoring this bill, so I haven't heard that it's been scheduled for a floor vote yet because we're tied up in a budget. The budget here is over 2 months late now. In fact, I think it's 3 months late. So the legislature's pretty preoccupied with that. But I think once that gets done, we'll start seeing perhaps that bill will get a an actual vote on the floor of the assembly.
Righto. Well, again, we'll be looking to check up with you as this hemp legislation moves forward. Also, Gary, this weekend there's a big event taking place, and a long-running event at that. The annual Harvest Festival starts up this Saturday. Tell us a bit about the event.
Yeah, this has been going on for 37 years. It's the Great Midwest Marijuana Harvest Festival, and this was started in 1970. And since about the third year, Ben Mizell, a well-known local activist and hemp activist, normal activist, has been the lead organizer of this, and in the last few years, Madison Normal, after we were founded, have become one of the prime backers of this, too. And it's a really an amazing event, and the whole weekend kicks off on Friday night with a benefit for Is My Medicine Legal Yet? And medical cannabis in Wisconsin at the Cardinal Bar in downtown Madison on 418 East Wilson. It's a really cool little bar, and we're going to have some excellent live music, some musicians who've been playing great blues and roots music for decades, the Radio Shanahan Band, and they're also going to be backing up Jim O'Hearn, who and the Whiskey River Band, and he does a tribute to Willie Nelson, so we'll have a little bit of Willie there. And Saturday, all day down adjacent to the UW campus at the Library Mall at the foot of State Street at Lake in downtown Madison, we'll be having live music and speakers and vendors and informational tabling all day long with some of the finest Wisconsin jam bands and other bands. We got a good selection of progressive rock from Baghdad Scuba Review. We got blues from Tate and the 008 Band. We got jam rock from Elf Lettuce. We have reggae from Nama Rupa. That's just a great all-day event from 12 to 6. And then on Sunday, We're going to gather back at Library Mall 12:30, listen to some bluegrass music and a few speakers. And then the real centerpiece of the whole Great Midwest Marijuana Harvest Festival happens around 3 a.m., and that is the traditional parade up State Street to the State Street steps of the Capitol, where we'll be having live music from Little Marsh Overflow and also speakers. And over the years, this march is thousands and thousands of people have participated in it. I've seen there's a video on the web from the 1989 Harvest Fest where at least 10,000 people go streaming in front of the camera, many of them indulging in cannabis. The last few years, we've had 1,000 or more, and we're hoping for that at least this year. But this is a free speech protest against marijuana being illegal, and a lot of the participants of this parade openly smoke cannabis marching up State Street. It's one of the coolest things to be in. Everybody's really happy. You just see cannabis freedom breaking out, smiles. You really have to experience it to understand what it's like, but it's just an awesome thing. In 2005, we had Keith Strope back here for Harvest Fest, and he marched in it, and it's just amazing. And if you're anywhere near Wisconsin, I'd urge you to get in your car and head to Madison this weekend, because this is something that you really need to experience.
And how does the local media treat the Harvest Festival?
Well, it's varied over the years. They've gone from scoffing at it to ignoring it, to the last few years to covering it pretty nicely. I think there's such a Madison is a city that is constantly the subject of tormented by alcohol. We have a Badger games here. The city has too many bars, and every day you read about problems with alcohol. So I think it's becoming more and more cannabis friendly in that regard, because there is so much problems here with alcohol, and it's just amazing to see this kind of cannabis freedom break out and the smiles and everything else. People don't believe it's happening.
Well, that's very cool. And because Madison is a university town, I assume there are a lot of young people out at this event as well.
Right. It's really the young people who kind of lead the way. It seems like the older people are afraid of getting photographed or something like that during the march. And But we've really been able to give it a medical spin the last few years, too. And the press has, talked to the patients. But it's also the personal freedom angle has really been going well with the press, too. And I think they're really beginning to understand that cannabis is really a safer alternative and that cannabis prohibition is wrong.
Now, we touched on the decriminalization ordinance in Madison, but this event really shows how much public support there is for marijuana reform in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we have a really good Madison Normal chapter here, too. We meet the second and fourth Mondays of the month, so we'll actually be meeting on Monday night, and I hope everybody's not too tired after the weekend. But we get some real good turnouts at our last meeting. We had close to 24 people there ready to offer their volunteer services to help make Harvest Fest a success. And we've been seeing real good numbers and a lot of interest. And we've also been tabling at a local theater productions. They've been doing Reefer Madness, the musical here in Madison. And
yeah,
we've been out tabling at that for a number of nights and getting a good reception there, too.
So not just the public coming out to this big event, but it sounds like there's a group of very active citizens there as well.
Yeah, we have a real good core of people, and then a lot of other people show up pretty regularly to meetings, and it's just really nice to have that cannabis community. In fact, we're kind of a beacon, and it's not unusual for people to drive a couple hundred miles from points around Wisconsin just to come to a Normal meeting and meet like-minded people. There's a real need for groups like Normal in Wisconsin, and other cities have less active chapters, but Madison's is really doing well, and I hope to see that spread around the state more.
Righto, Gary. This has just been a wonderful conversation here today, covering a lot of ground. We have links to Madison Normal and Take Action links to the specific pieces of legislation we discussed here today. We'll also have links to the Harvest Festival. Gary, thank you again for joining us here today, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris, and I'm so glad to be on.
Thank you again. Gary Stork is the director of Madison, Wisconsin Normal. We have links to everything we discussed today with Gary on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Our interview with Ryan King from the Sentencing Project coming up next.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
On the Audio Stash, we're going to speak with Ryan King of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, The Sentencing Project, about a new paper he co-authored with Mark Maurer. The paper's entitled The 25-Year Quagmire, The War on Drugs, and Its Impact on Society. It details the 500,000 Americans in prison currently for drug prohibition-related offenses, and the paper calls for a new strategy. We have links to the paper today at normalaudiostash.com. Ryan, welcome to the program today.
Thanks for having me on.
Very good to speak with you today, Ryan. Thank you again for joining us. Now, tell us a bit of the overview here of this last 25 years of drug prohibition incarceration data.
We wanted to pull together a collection of all of the official statistics that are available to create kind of a single go-to guide for what the drug war has really been over the last 25 years. I think there's a lot of rhetoric and misinformation that's passed around, and so we wanted to break it down and look at all of the stages from arrest through sentencing and incarceration, impact on community, so that any individual who really wants to get a sense of where we've come since 1980, since President Reagan declared the war on drugs, can get that sort of sense.
And Ryan, in what period of time have we seen prohibition arrests go up the most? Or are we perhaps in the middle of that right now?
Well, I think we're still in the middle of it. The attention is not the same as it was, let's say, 15, 20 years ago. But we're still, I think, knee-deep in it. What I think is most interesting is that the war on drugs is really divided up into two very distinct eras. After it was declared by the Reagan administration in the early 1980s, the emphasis at that time had been on marijuana around 1980-1981, the majority of arrests were for marijuana. It switched dramatically during the 1980s, and we saw a decline in the number of marijuana arrests and an increase in the number of heroin and cocaine arrests, which I think really underscores the role of discretion among law enforcement, because there were no changes in drug use patterns that would really suggest that those dramatic increases and that dramatic change in the scope of law enforcement. And then suddenly, as if switching on a light switch in the 1990s, we saw a complete turnaround, and we saw the emphasis switch once again back towards marijuana, and that has continued to this day up until as recently as just a couple of days ago, where we see continued record numbers of arrests for marijuana. So we've really got, when we talk about the war on drugs, we've really got two very distinct eras that we need to discuss, and they both raise very important policy questions.
Ryan, we've highlighted the racial disparity of prohibition enforcement arrests in relation to marijuana here on the Audio Stash, but does that racial disparity exist for most prohibition arrests and incarcerations?
It's across the board for all drugs. I can unequivocally say that there's really no single factor when you look at all the impact on criminal justice system. I don't think there's any single factor that has so exacerbated racial inequality in the criminal justice system as the war on drugs. I mean, it certainly predated racial disparities in law enforcement and in sentencing and corrections, certainly predated the war on drugs declaration in 1980. But I think when you look at those figures now, 25 years later, you can directly tie them back to the enforcement patterns in the war on drugs and the way in which sentencing laws have impacted African-American communities.
Now, we've seen a lot of issues dealing with outright racism or racial equality. Some make big news, like the Gina Six case recently, but Why is drug prohibition barely, if ever, mentioned in that context, do you think?
I think one of the biggest problems, whether it's prohibition or whether we're talking more broadly just about investment in prevention and treatment rather than using law enforcement as a means to address drug abuse, is that the conversation, one of the issues of the war on drugs, it wasn't merely just putting out more law enforcement, making more punitive sentencing laws and putting more people in prison. It was also really shaping the dialogue, the Just Say No campaign, the DARE campaign. It was shaping the dialogue in this country about drug use and what the proper response for it should be. So I can, as an example, I've done a number of radio shows in the past talking about the war on drugs, and frequently the opposition will say, well, you know, I go into these African-American communities and I talk to members of these communities. They're the ones who have to deal firsthand with the consequences of drug abuse, and many of them are often the most outspoken for the need of strict punishment for putting people in prison. And my response to that is that the discourse in this country is so narrow around drug abuse, it's been shaped in such a way that the only way you can address it is blocking people up, that certainly anybody who lives in a community that is dealing with high level of drug abuse, they're not calling for more people in prison. What they're calling for is to feel safe in their neighborhood. What they're calling for is to have people who are using drugs have options for treatment. But they only know the one option that we tell them, which is prison. That's the way most Americans respond. And so I think we need to broaden the conversation. I think that in a lot of these African-American communities, the fact of the matter is they deal with the criminal justice system, and they see that most people aren't getting treatment. They're being locked up. They're just being warehoused in there. And I think that ultimately, if we broaden the discussion to one of would you like to see people locked up for prison, would you like to see more investment in prevention and treatment, I have no doubt that in many of these African-American communities, as well as I think in most communities across the country, the response would be let's invest in prevention and treatment. Let's not be destroying families and communities.
Also, one trend that dominates across the racial and ethnic lines of these arrests is that most of those who fall prey to prohibition laws are young men.
It absolutely is, and these are the people that are filling up our prisons and jails, a half a million at this point that are currently in for a drug offense. And what's really tragic about it is when you say, we're talking very young men, we're talking 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. These are individuals who really should be in the prime of their life. They should be in school. They should be beginning jobs and families. And instead, what we've chosen to do to respond to that is simply to lock people up. And the impact on an individual's life, I mean, put yourself in the position of when you were 19 or 20 years old. Maybe you had your first job. Maybe you were in college. Maybe you were beginning a family. Imagine then at that point that you press the pause button. You're taken out for 1 or 2 years. And put away in a prison. Then when you come back out, you have the stigma of the felony conviction. You can't get a job. You can't live in certain places. You can't get education and student loans. Your life is forever changed. And for many people, essentially, you could really be ruining a young person's life when they're 18 or 19 years old for a decision that it would be very different than when they're 30, 40, or 50. I mean, I'm 34 years old now. I'm a very different person than I was when I was 24 years old. And I think one of the real tragedies of the war on drugs is this young generation, future generation of African-American men and of white men, Latino men, really of all backgrounds, these people's lives are essentially being forever affected for decisions when they're 18 and 19, when really giving a person a second chance and another opportunity should be our primary goal rather than just essentially ruining individuals' lives at such a young age.
Ryan, you and Mark Maurer offer a number of potential solutions and policy changes in the paper, but what do you think would be the best first step towards reform here?
Well, we talk very specifically in here about changing mandatory sentencing laws, returning discretion to judges, investing in treatment, those sort of things, and I think all those are very concrete steps and are very important. But I think, honestly, the biggest thing we need to do is to get the conversation I mentioned earlier about the level of dialogue about the war on drugs in this country. We need to get people to speak about it differently. Now, when I work on a number of criminal justice issues outside of the war on drugs, and the war on the way that the war on drugs has changed in the public perception the last 15 years is remarkable. I mean, if you go back to when the first Bush was president, and you can remember that for most Americans in public opinion surveys, the war on drugs and drug abuse is considered public enemy number one. This is the biggest concern. now we have a Republican administration. We have the ONDCP that's at least talking about treatment, funding treatment, pushing drug courts. It's certainly not where we want to be, but I think it's a dramatic step forward. And that, to me, has come as a result not of politicians taking the lead by any stretch, but of the public finally standing up, saying we're fed up with this, this doesn't work, and we need to seek better options. So my goal is to continue that discourse, to get more people talking about it, to ensure that when research comes out that shows that there are better ways to deal with drug use in this country, when there are a deprioritization of marijuana enforcement in certain jurisdictions around the country, when there's a diversion programs, alternatives to incarceration that are coming up, when law enforcement leaders are taking progressive steps, and individuals are thinking more broadly about better ways to address drug use. Those are the kind of things we need to highlight. We need to make sure that everybody in America knows about them, that these aren't little pilot programs that exist in isolation somewhere, but these are really important decisions that are being made that everybody should be looking towards. So that, to me, is just to continue the conversation we're having right now and continue it going forward, because I do think, without question, that it's the public that will really lead for change.
And do you think this issue is something that demands large civil rights demonstrations? Can these reforms come from lobbying local and national elected officials? Or is this issue something that big-name politicians really need to take on before we see some progress?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think the battle, the war is big enough that we need to fight the battle on a number of different fronts. And so we do need to have people lobbying Congress. We need to really push the financial impact. I mean, that's what's gotten a lot of Republican leaders and conservatives to come out critical of the war on drugs. And I think we need to continue to push that angle. So it's not always going to be we need to find the common ground that's going to get individuals to realize how wrongheaded the war on drugs policy has been pursued over the last 25 years and how ineffective. And so for some individuals, it's going to be a social justice issue. For some individuals, it's going to be a civil rights issue. And for some, it's going to be a purely fiscal issue. And we need to find that common ground and pull together all those different unlikely allies to get them together. The fact of the matter is that the war on drugs is so pervasive. It has affected so many people. And it goes into all different spheres of life. So for people who work on housing issues, on education, on health care, on community reinvestment, all of those individuals may not think of the war on drugs as something they should be paying attention to, but it is. And so it's our job for those who do work on this issue to reach out to different organizations, different constituencies, find common ground, and get those people, bring them into the fight as well.
Righto, Ryan. Well, this has been a great conversation here today. I can't thank you enough for joining us here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again. Ryan King is with the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit The Sentencing Project. His new paper, co-authored with Mark Maurer, is The 25-Year Quagmire, The War on Drugs and Its Impact on Society. We have links to it right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about everyday's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.